Hi, and welcome to Forecast, a podcast about climate science and climate scientists. I am Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today, I'm excited to have Lorraine Lazicki on the show. There's a few kinds of paleoclimate scientists. You can think of them as being broadly into categories like the people who are going out doing the lake or ocean drilling or gathering the paleo archives of past variations in temperature or precipitation. And then you have a similarly large community of climate modelers who are doing the numerical modeling of past climate variability. And those communities are increasingly working together. But those two communities don't necessarily have the analytical skills in-house that they might like to have in order to try and understand what's really going on with these past records or the model simulations. In some cases they do, but not always. There's a niche market for people like Lorraine who have really strong quantitative mathematical skills in trying to interpret the archives themselves. So Lorraine's not a modeler and she's not a data gatherer. Instead, she's using mathematical, numerical, quantitative techniques to try and understand what's happened in the past. And in particular, she's well known for working with the benthic records of Delta O18. So there's your past variations and oxygen 18 relative to oxygen 16, which are a combined indicator of variations in ice volume and ocean temperatures, at least since we have ice in the climate system. So since the rise of the East Antarctic Ice Sheet, in particular, at the EOT. Lorraine's also the first author of one of the most famous papers in all of paleoclimate science, or the most cited, and this is the LR04 record, actually published in 2005, but it's this famous benthic stack where she's taken together 57 different records of Delta O18 variability and come up with a stacked record of global variability in Delta O18 and trying to assign ages to all of these different peaks and valleys. And it's been just incredibly useful. So we talk a lot about how that kind of work began and how Lorraine's background going to a residential high school for science and mathematics and then her time at MIT really kind of prepared her for that. Let me go through Lorraine's career working to get to University of California at Santa Barbara after working at Brown and Boston University with people like Mo Ramo, excellent people like that. And Lorraine's had a fascinating time at UCSB having triplets, but actually seeming to go through the whole tenure and promotion process pretty straightforwardly and not having many difficulties with trying to manage that level of family commitment and reaching a good place in terms of her interest in science and her ability to contribute to that while still having what she likes to have in terms of a family life. Otherwise, I've been blathering on about this meeting I'm going to in Tasmania, Hobart, Tasmania, at the end of the month. And as many of you have probably seen in the news, there's been an announcement by the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO, that they're essentially going to cut in half the staff dedicated to climate modeling and monitoring. And of course, I'm going to go visit the CSIRO Institute down in Hobart. And it sounds like the job cuts are going to be announced in terms of the personnel just a couple of days before I arrive. So I can't imagine what that visit's going to be like. I debated kind of calling it off, just trying to be sensitive to what was going on down there, but they still wanted me to come. So I'll let you know how that all goes and what I learn when I'm down there. With that, on to the show. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks a lot. Lorraine Lazicki from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So it turns out that we have a little bit of commonality in our backgrounds, although sort of the reverse way. My father is from North Carolina, but then was raised by his parents in New York, and they came back to North Carolina at the end. You were raised in South Carolina, but from New York parents. What was that experience like having parents from the North growing up in the Deep South? Were they perfectly happy being down there? Or was there a bit of a culture clash?
They really like it there. You know, there's a little bit of adjustment to understanding some of the things that people are saying, but they enjoy it there. They actually moved down to South Carolina for my mom to go to law school.
When was that?
That was before I was born.
And what did your father do?
He is a software engineer.
And so you said that they had some difficulties understanding some of the things that were said down there. Do you mean just because of the accents or because of the actual words that were being said?
I think a combination. My dad told me a story about he was talking to someone about press the enter key, and they were like, "What do you mean?" And so he's trying to explain it. You mean mash?
Oh, mash the key. I've never heard that expression before. I would be completely lost, I think.
This was quite a while ago when computers were new, so I imagine everybody today would know what press the enter key was.
So where do you stand on the spectrum of Southern barbecue preferences, if at all?
Oh, I love South Carolina barbecue. It's a mustard-based barbecue. So whenever I go visit, we always get some barbecue.
Is that the kind of barbecue where it's done in a pit and then shredded into fine pieces, or is it something else?
Yes. Yeah.
So my wife described that barbecue as tasting like vomit. And I could kind of see that, but I thought it was really much better than that. Now you grew up in the kind of the periphery of Lexington. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was it kind of a farm life, or were you living in a city and you had professional parents? How did you interact with the countryside?
Well, we started in kind of a suburb development, and then when I was in elementary school, my parents bought a big piece of land out in the country, and my mom has always liked horses, so they built a barn and got some horses. So we lived out in the woods, and I really loved it. Actually, I think that probably really contributes to my love of nature and may have ultimately affected my career choices. Who knows?
Did you ride a lot when you were a kid?
I did ride some. I never really got into it as much as my mom and my sister did.
But just the fact of being out there, away from the city, out in the country, and the trees had an impact on you. What do you think it did to you in the long term? Just an appreciation for being out, being by yourself, having that kind of quiet, calm experience?
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
And what was your high school like? Was it a situation where you had to commute long distances in a bus, or were you able to sort of walk down the street to your school?
Well, I took a bus. It wasn't walking distance, but it wasn't that far. The Lexington High School is a very good high school. And then my last 2 years of high school, I actually went to the South Carolina Governor's School for Science and Math, which is a residential high school for the top students in the state to really focus on science and math. So that was a tremendous opportunity.
Is that the equivalent of a boarding school where you're actually living in the school itself?
Yes.
Huh. I've never even heard of something like that. How many kids were there?
It was smaller when I was there. I think it was maybe about 120 students, so 60 seniors and 60 juniors. But it's gotten bigger now, so I think it may be a few hundred students now.
And were the students that went there identified by testing or through their own initiative or parental involvement?
So you had to apply. There were test scores, and I sort of got involved with that actually even before that, because I went to a summer camp. They host summer camps for middle school age kids. So I started just by going to a summer camp for sciences there and really loved it.
What happens during a summer science camp? I guess you're not going out and doing the sort of sporting things you might expect from a regular American summer camp. Was it some of that and then a lot of mathematics, or what actually happened?
The reason that I actually selected that, because lots of colleges hold summer camps for students like after the eighth grade. And so I was getting lots of brochures. And the reason I selected that one is because there was absolutely no sports. Like, this is the one for me. I don't have to do any sports while I'm there.
Did they advertise that there were no sports, or did you just sort of figure it out?
I just figured it out. Yeah.
This is the one for me. So you've never had, well, you said that you like to ride a little bit, but not as much. You've never had an interest in sort of the sporting life, I take it.
No, I'm more of an in my head kind of person.
Looking at the papers of yours that I've read, I guess it's not surprising that you had an interest in science camp. When did you sort of begin to realize that you had a facility and aptitude and actually enjoyed doing mathematics?
I think a lot of it comes from my dad, because he was a physics major and then became a software engineer. So when I was growing up, we would often have conversations about physics and science. And so that was just something that I grew up with. So I was always good in math classes and in the math club and things like that.
I talked to Amy Clement, an atmospheric dynamicist, a little while ago, and her father was also an engineer, and she made the comment that engineers are as far away from science as artists. but it sounds like in your case, your father had a little bit more of a bent towards physics and to science and wasn't as far away from science as one might imagine from an engineering background. How did he think about the career that you were getting into from his perspective as an engineer? Did it make complete sense to him, the topics and the approaches you were taking?
Yeah, I think my parents have always been really supportive of whatever I wanted to do. I imagine that most parents might be concerned about sort of careers in science just because they're not as profitable, perhaps, as going to something in the private sector. But both my parents were supportive. I think my mom doesn't really understand very well what I do, but since she's more of a humanities sort of person, they're both very supportive, and I think they think it's really cool.
Clearly, the experiences you had at the summer camp and then in the intensive high school were good preparation, because you ended up getting into MIT and getting your bachelor's degree at MIT. Was it a big stretch going from that high school to MIT, or did you kind of get in and say, yeah, this is not that different from high school?
It really wasn't that different. Yeah, it was a very smooth adjustment because you're sort of surrounded by people who are, you know, really focused on science and math. The teachers at the Governor's School all have PhDs, and
they teach
the courses more like a college class. It was very good preparation.
When you were at MIT, were you, I have no idea what the curriculum is like there. Is it just focused on science and mathematics, or do you have the opportunity there to begin to develop your own conceptual interests?
Well, they have a humanities requirement for everybody.
Oh, really? I have, this is shocking.
Yeah, so most schools, they have, you know, math and science requirements, and at MIT, they force you have to take some humanities classes.
Oh, more than one.
Yeah, you have to have like some sort of little minor. It's like a group of four classes on something. It's funny, most of the students there do economics for their humanities because it's as close to math as they can get. But I actually did writing. I've always been interested in fiction writing and science fiction. So that was actually what I did for my humanities requirement.
Did you publish any of that work?
No, I didn't publish anything. It was fun. And I think, you know, it was a good experience to, you know, as a scientist, we have to do a lot of writing. It ended up being beneficial to me, I think.
What's the range of possibilities at MIT? Could you have done things like archaeology or gender studies, or was the swath of the humanities options fairly limited?
They have a wide range. They just have smaller enrollments than you would have at a typical university.
And then you stayed at MIT to get the first of your two master's degrees in geosystems. What is geosystems?
It was a program that was designed to teach modeling of any sort of system in the earth science. So we actually did a wide range of things from Carrie Emanuel taught a section on modeling hurricanes. We had a section on mantle convection. I think we did something with the atmosphere of Jupiter. So we just had, I think they were like 4-week sections of intensive education about different systems and how you would model them.
So the idea is to train your brain on how to model anything, not to model one particular system.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic idea, really. I've never come across that kind of curriculum before. Did it work in your case? Did it make sense to you that you sort of were working on mantle convection one day and then looking at hurricanes the next section?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of those are the same sort of fluid dynamics equations just applied to different problems. So it's not as different as it might seem. In my case, I did it the program because I knew I liked modeling. I liked working on the computer and doing the math and the physics, but I hadn't yet identified like what geoscience question to me was most interesting. So it was an opportunity. I had done planetary science as an undergrad because it was mostly math and physics, but I hadn't really identified a particular question about planetary science that I was passionate about. So this was an opportunity to try out different things. And so that's actually when I did my master's project with John Marshall on ocean general circulation models. And so that's really how I transitioned into paleoclimate.
And from that, moved on to a second master's at Brown. Was that a direct development of your interest in ocean modeling?
Well, I applied to Brown as an undergraduate for the planetary science program. I got in there, but decided I wanted to do the 1 year master's program. So then I just said, can I get back in the following year? they said, okay. And then I showed up and I said, but actually I want to do paleoclimate instead of planetary science. Luckily, they were very welcoming and allowing me to switch focuses like that.
So I guess Brown has a reputation for letting you roll your own however you want to. So this is very much within the remit of the school, I suppose. And did you then go to work right away with Tim Herbert?
Yeah. So when I showed up, I spoke with the different professors there who were doing paleoclimate. And Tim had a project that sounded interesting to me. So I started working with him on wiggle matching, which is a large part of what I ended up doing for my PhD, is how do you figure out how the signal in one record lines up with the signal in another record based on the orbital cyclicity.
The term wiggle matching is, of course, one of the most fantastic terms in all of paleoclimate. Can you talk a little bit more about what actually happens when wiggle matching? Why is wiggle matching needed in the first place? And then how do you do it? You had your paper, I think 2002 was looking at that. What kind of progress did you make on that technique?
So when I started, you know, as a first year grad student, I was trying to find the approach of just looking at the two records and trying to figure out which wiggles correspond with which ones. I mean, the basic problem is that when you're looking in deep time, so beyond the range of radiocarbon, which only goes back about 30 or 40,000 years, you don't have very good ways to estimate the age of something. You only get really coarse resolution with respect to magnetic reversals if you happen to be in a core that has a magnetic record. And you have some coarse resolution from the looking at the species that you find in the sediment at the time. So you only have a very general idea of what time period you're looking at. And so the way we develop a more refined age model is to look at the oxygen isotopes, which record changes in ice volume and deep water temperature. And so the cycles have a little bit of variability from one cycle to the next. Some are larger and some are smaller. Some are kind of wider and have kind of double peaks or whatever. So you try to look at the features of those cycles to figure out how can you line them up so that you have the same pattern from one core as in the other core, so that you're looking at the same time period. But it's very intensive. Time intensive to try to do it by eye.
In other words, sort of picking one peak in one curve from one part of the ocean and saying that that same peak is at the same time as this peak over here and these 20 or 30 other cores, and doing it manually, sort of peak and bottom one at a time.
Yeah. And actually, I think the first records I was working on, rather than oxygen isotopes, I was just looking at the sort of physical properties of the sediment, things like reflectivity or color and density curves and things like that, because this was looking further back in time where I started. And so then I got kind of, well, there must be a better way to do this. I was complaining about it to my husband.
Perhaps you can use math.
Yeah. And since he's a software engineer, he was like, "Oh yeah, there's this algorithm that we can use to figure it out mathematically. What's the best alignment?" I was like, "Oh no, there's too many things we'd have to worry about: sedimentation rate changes, and so we sort of worked out together a way to adapt this algorithm to take into account the sort of things that a geologist would think about when they're trying to line up these records, so that we're doing it in a physically realistic way, but also solving the math to find the best match between the two records."
It's not just purely nihilistic approach. You do have to put in some sort of metadata about the individual records that can then get ingested into the algorithm.
Well, it's not metadata so much. It's you put in the depth information, because every
right.
measurement comes from a certain depth in the core. So you have depth and you have whatever measurement, be it oxygen isotopes or some other sediment property. From those two, you can take a look at what the sedimentation rate changes would be in order to do the alignment. We weren't the first people to do a mathematical algorithm to do this. So there was paper in the 80s by Martinson. But the algorithm that we did found a globally optimal solution, whereas previous ones were local optimal solutions. So you had to start out with a pretty good guess. Our algorithm is easier to use and gives probably more reliable results, although of course I am biased about that. And actually, I've taken it one step further now, which is that the solution that the algorithm that we developed as a when I was a grad student, was it spit out one answer, like, okay, this is the best solution. There were some sort of parameters that you could tweak to adjust it by how much sedimentation rate change you wanted or something like that. But now I've been working with Chip Lawrence and the applied math department at Brown, and we've come up with a version that, in addition to finding the best solution, gives you uncertainty. So you have now, oh, well, this part of the alignment is pretty good. I know that within about 2,000 years, this part of the alignment is really uncertain. It could be off by 10,000 years. So I think that is another important advance in that.
Just guessing, but with the technique that you have, I wouldn't think necessarily that the uncertainties would have to expand as you go farther back in time. Is that the case, or do they have this sort of increasing uncertainty in time?
They don't have to. It turns out that if you're looking at oxygen isotopes, we have big glacial cycles in the relatively recent past, the last million years. If you go back 5 million years, the cyclicity has a much smaller amplitude, so the signal to noise is not as good. So if you're talking about oxygen isotope alignments over 5 million years, you do actually have bigger uncertainties further back in the past, but it's just because the climate variability was weaker then.
When you're back in the 40,000 year world with lower delta Ovaltine amplitude.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about delta Ovaltine itself and the way that it's been interpreted in the paleoclimate community. I sort of have this perception that even though people know that there's a ice volume overprint on it, it's still often taken to be a fairly straightforward indicator of temperature, or if you're interested in ice volume, the reverse, where in fact you have to try and disentangle the two, which is of course difficult. Can you just talk a little bit about what the benthic record itself, delta Ovaltine, is really telling you, and how you yourself think about that when you're trying to look at things like orbital forcings on the record?
Great question. Yeah, that's something that goes along with the whole history of paleoceanography, is this question of what's the temperature component versus the ice volume component of oxygen isotopes. The benthic foraminifera are incorporating the oxygen isotopes into their calcium carbonate shells based on the oxygen isotope composition of the water that they're living in and the temperature of that water. We have pretty good calibration curves for how much oxygen isotope changes as a function of temperature. But then if you can't separate out what the ice volume was, then you wouldn't be able to get a temperature. And I should say that the oxygen isotopes of the water they're living in are affected predominantly by ice volume change as you remove oxygen-16 from the ocean and store it in an ice sheet. But it's not just ice volume in that affects the seawater. It's also affected by the hydrological cycle. So the evaporation and precipitation on the ocean surface and the deep water formation processes like sea ice formation, changes in those will also affect the seawater values of oxygen isotopes at different locations in the ocean.
All of which are fairly poorly constrained as you go back to, let's say, the Pliocene.
Yeah.
The variations in ocean circulation or evaporation.
Right. And so the sort of recent advances are that we have people developing magnesium-calcium temperature estimates for benthic oxygen isotope records so that we can get an estimate of what the temperature was and try to remove that to get at what we would then consider an ice volume signal, even though it contains also some artifacts from hydrological cycle changes as well.
And do you think the magnesium-calcium, what you call the residual approach, has been fairly robust so far, or are there still major uncertainties in that?
Well, I think it depends on the sort of time scale. That, yeah, when you talk about the Pliocene, you could have differences in the magnesium composition of the concentrations in the oceans. So you'd have to be careful about as you go further back in time. Of course, you also want to think about the uncertainties that are associated with each of those measurements. When you take a residual, you're sort of compounding your uncertainties. You end up with records that are a little bit noisy looking and also have some local signals, like I said, from the sort of salinity or hydrologic variability of the ocean.
If you were to hazard a speculation, if you were to think about the residual ice volume term going back through deep time in the Delta Eocene record, and you mentioned that you can kind of estimate it by removing out the magnesium calcium temperatures, but that there is a residual term from things like ocean circulation or evaporation or these other factors. What kind of uncertainty would you sort of estimate you still have on the ice volume estimates from those other unconstrained factors? It's just impossible to say at this point.
I don't have a number to give you. One approach that we've been working on with one of my grad students is we've actually stacked some sea level records. So different ways of estimating the sea level, either by removing temperature components or other techniques that people have used to try to back calculate an ice volume from an oxygen isotope record. And so that's one approach that we're taking, is to say, well, you've got records from different locations. If you use different techniques to try to back out what the ice volume was, then you've got different sources of error from each of those signals. So if we combine 6 or 7 of those, then we can get sort of a better handle on what the ice volume might have actually been. And from that analysis, you still get sort of a wide level of disagreement from those individual records that have tried to. So if you look at marine isotope stage 11, which is about 400,000 years ago, one of the warmest interglacials of the late Pleistocene, that's the sort of difference you get depending on what proxies you're using to reconstruct sea level.
So my first response is that's really a big uncertainty. We think that in the last interglacial, the sea level rise was maybe, I don't know, something like 6 to 9 meters above present with a little bit warmer climate. But you're saying that in MIS 11, that the uncertainty is 20 meters.
There are, of course, other ways like coral to try to get what the level is. But in terms of how confident we are of reconstructing sea level by removing the temperature component from a benthic oxygen isotope record or a planktonic oxygen isotope record, that's the sort of variability.
So the answer is not very, it sounds like. But I guess, you know, those kind of records are the ones that are available to us if we want to go much farther back in time. So it's sort of really important to try and understand what the level of uncertainties really is.
Right. And I think that's really something that's important for the paleoclimate community to moving forward, is to try to quantify what our uncertainties are as much as we can, to try to consider all the possible factors that are affecting our results, and to be really honest with ourselves about how well do we know things and how well are different records agreeing with one another.
One trend that I've noticed over the past few years looking at just submissions to Nature is that a groundswell by any means, but there is a growing collaboration between the statistical community and the paleoclimate community, and it's showing up in things like the sea level estimates from Bob Kopp and Carling Hay and those kind of efforts, where they're looking at trying to ingest all the available information as you've been doing, but putting it into a Bayesian uncertainty approach and coming up with a quantification of the uncertainties. That said, I still see a huge number of submissions coming into Nature where you have just a single line of whatever proxy reconstruction that might be going back for 2-3 million years with no uncertainties at all, like just the numbers themselves for, let's just say, a single core or a lake record. What's your perspective on where the field is with these two endpoints? Is it moving more towards one direction, or is it sort of mostly staying in the other direction of having still limited uncertainties?
Well, I think we are moving in the direction, in that I think if you looked 10 or 20 years ago, you didn't have any Bayesian uncertainty analysis, right? So,
right.
So we have some sort of pioneers in moving in that direction, and I hope that it's a trend that will continue. I think especially as models are getting more sophisticated and we have isotope-enabled models, that quantifying what our uncertainties are in the records that we want to compare to the models becomes more important. Because if you're trying to say, does the model agree with the data, you need to know, well, how close does it have to agree with the data? What are the uncertainties in the data? So I think that is a strong motivating factor to try to develop uncertainties for these records.
I guess you also have the perverse possibility that once you really do understand how large the uncertainties are, that any number of model possibilities might be valid within the uncertainties of the observational record.
Well, I don't think we've gotten to that point yet, but I do know that it's very hard to get papers published when your conclusion is that the uncertainties are too big to solve the signal.
Have you experienced that personally where editors are saying...
Yeah, today we got a rejection letter for a paper because our conclusion was the uncertainties were too large.
Really? That was the specific editorial decision that the uncertainties were too large to justify publishing?
Well, it was the reviewer's comments, you know, which led to the recommendation that... Can you make the paper more interesting by being able to conclude anything?
That's an interesting conundrum because clearly there should be a place for publishing papers that are breaking that message. And I guess it's sort of a question of what journal is the right match for that in particular. I think we have journals like PLOS ONE and Scientific Reports now where the specific goal is not to publish a earth-shattering conclusion, but it's to publish work that is technically robust. Do you see those kinds of journals as being a good match for that style of work, or do you think that they really should be in more of the specialist journals?
Possibly. It is good that we have those options. I think, though, that we need to, as a community, realize that having information about what our uncertainties are should be interesting, even if we find that the uncertainties are large, right? That should be a message that we're willing to listen.
Yeah, agreed. Going back for a minute to your LR04, the Lissicki and Ramo 2004 stack.
It's actually a 2005.
I know. I've never understood why it's called the LR04 record if it was published in 2005.
Well, it was.
I guess it was probably submitted.
It was written in 2004, and it came out for publication. It actually came out in January of 2005.
Okay.
So it was unfortunate timing.
I think if you look at a lot of geoscience papers, if they're cited more than 100 times, you know, that's a relatively high level of citation for a paper in geosciences, including papers in Nature and Science. But the LR4 paper has been cited almost 2,000 times in the intervening 11 years. Which is absolutely monstrous for a paper in geoscience. It's sort of on the level of the earth-shattering ice core papers. Almost nothing gets cited this much. What are your thoughts on why the paper has been such an incredible blockbuster? Why did the community need this paper so badly? And were you surprised by the reaction?
Well, you know, I was a grad student at the time, so I didn't really quite have the perspective of...
You're like, oh, someone has cited my paper. That's so great. And that's what I always thought.
Yeah, at the time that I was doing this, there was still sort of disagreement about the ages for isotope stage 11 and how long isotope stage 11 was, because the age models were coming from individual cores. Of course, there were previous stacks, but... they were from a smaller number of records. So I think that the success really comes from the fact that we were at a point where there were a lot of existing records that we could combine, so that we were actually able to really improve the signal to noise and actually get a very clear picture, a pretty clear picture of what the benthic oxygen isotope actually looked like through time. And the approach of combining sedimentation rates from different cores in order to develop a fairly robust age estimates as well. So I think that there's just a qualitative difference between looking at a single record, even if it's very high resolution, and being able to combine 57 different records so that you really know that you're seeing a global signal. You're able to make pretty good guesses about, or pretty good estimates, they're not guesses, of ages. So we were able to make some pretty good arguments that some of the previous age estimates for stage 11 were off.
But it doesn't just cover stage 11. It also goes back to 5 million years ago. Is that about right?
Yeah. And I think, having that really long interval of time continuously is also really made it very useful for people, because it can be used not just for looking at the most recent several glacial cycles and comparing to ice cores, but also for people who are studying the Pliocene or the onset of Northern Hemisphere glaciation or the mid-Pleistocene transition, because it covers so many different interesting time intervals.
So what I see in submissions to Nature, this is what it seemed like to me a reason that it's been so successful, is that people will have a record from somewhere with an approximate time from stratigraphy or a very approximate date, but let's say they know it was around the MPT or something like this, and then they have a floating chronology. Maybe it's an annually varved record or something like this, and then they can pin it to the peaks or the values that are seen in the LRR4 record and ascribe it an absolute age. Has that been one of the major uses of that record?
Yeah, and it's before LRO4, there was the SpecMap stack and a series of other stacks. So the sort of concept of having a stack that you can pin it to is not new, but I think the qualitative improvement of the LRO4 stack compared to previous stacks has really made it more useful to people.
Something else that you worked on quite a bit around that time period, but also going forward for many years, was the relationship between the benthic delta Witteine record and orbital forcings, like changes in eccentricity in particular. Mm-hmm. What drew you to that field? What were the big unanswered questions? And what do you think your work did to move the field forward on the sort of climate orbital interactions?
You know, I was at Brown, which is where John Imbrie was. So there was this big tradition of looking at these sorts of questions. And just the sort of fundamental problem of why do we have glacial cycles? Why are they 100,000 years long? It's such a fundamental question that's really what drew me to it. Is I can't believe we don't know why we have 100,000 year cycles, right? This is the major feature of climate over the last million years. You know, we're making progress, but we still don't have it completely settled.
It seems like the debates continue to rage on this. I know there's debates about, does obliquity overprint onto the eccentricity cycles, or is it just sort of a culmination of several precessional cycles that ends up with an ice sheet that's sufficiently large to generate these massive retreats? Do you think that there are robust conclusions that the community as a whole would agree on in terms of the relationship between orbital forcings and glacial cycles?
Well, I think the community as a whole agrees that orbital forcing is responsible for glacial cycles.
That's about it.
I think what we're seeing is people who are working on models where they put the orbital forcing in and try to recreate the glacial cycles. And so I think sort of the test of whether we've got our understanding of what the important forcing is, are we able to reproduce the timing of the terminations in a way where we haven't overtuned it? One interesting question is the timing that we see in the geologic record actually deterministic? You know, is there, you know, one set of sensitivities that would describe the whole time period, or are there stochastic fluctuations that might explain why terminations get triggered at one time and not another? Is there evolution of the system even throughout the last 800,000 years such that maybe a single set of parameters wouldn't be enough to describe why we have terminations at a given time? So I think those are some of the really kind of questions that I grapple with in terms of, is there a nice simple answer that we would be able to get to of saying, oh yeah, it's, you know, 75% precession and 25% obliquity. I don't know if we'll get to a point like that or not. It's an interesting question. Are these cycles deterministic, or is there a role for stochastic variability?
Don't you think that it has to be a combination of both of those, because you have systematic shifts in glacial cycles, as you mentioned, going from the 40,000 to the 100,000 year world. You have a shift in 400,000 years ago, more or less, where the sort of the peak of the interglacials changed systematically in the Pleistocene. So it seems like there are major shifts in the major patterns of how glacial cycles work, but the individual terminations seem like they have a greater potential for being individualistically forced by some like unknown and shifting combination of factors. Is that, could it be sort of a story there that they're both going on simultaneously?
I think that's likely to be the case. I mean, we know about Heinrich events and millennial scale variability being very large over the last glacial time period. So I would certainly imagine that interplay of the millennial scale variability and the orbital scale variability may turn out to be important.
Moving on to your professional activities again, you're now at the University of California at Santa Barbara, which I think many people would think of as being possibly one of the nicest places in the entire country to work. And there must be a dark side. Why, what's the dark side about being at UC Santa Barbara?
I don't know. I don't have any, not any complaints. I used to have a view of the ocean from my window in my office, but they built a greenhouse.
Curses, biologists.
But no, I love it here. I just feel so fortunate that events aligned that I ended up here.
You did a postdoc, then you had a research position, I think, at Boston University with Mo Ramo, around which time the LRR4 paper came out. 2008, you had a paper in Nature, which I guess was right around the time you were beginning your job at UC Santa Barbara. Was it those kinds of things that you think made you competitive for that position? Or were there other things going on sort of professionally that made you a good match for that?
Well, certainly the fact that LRR4 was being very well received for the community must have helped. I think it was a match of a position opening up that matched well with what I did in terms of David Lee being here looking at orbital cycles. This position basically opened up as a result of Jim Kennett retiring. And so they were looking for, I think, sort of a traditional paleoceanographer. That's probably how this ended up working out.
I'm guessing that there was not a major issue in convincing the family to come to Santa Barbara.
Well, it worked out well because my husband's family is from California. So he was happy to move here closer to his family.
I met you at the IPICS meeting in France several years ago now, International Partnerships for Ice Core Science or something like that. And at the time, I seem to remember you telling me that you have triplets.
Right. Yeah, they were born in 2011. That IPICS meeting was actually my very first meeting that I went to after they were born. So it was really nice to get away to the Mediterranean.
Did you find having triplets to be as sort of an explosive life event as I can imagine it being?
It was, yeah, I mean, it was something that was, really challenging to deal with, but also very rewarding. It makes me appreciate my work more. I get to kind of have two separate lives, spending time with them, but also having time where things aren't quite crazy and I get to, spend time thinking.
If I have this right, you were also promoted in 2012, around the same time as you had the triplets. Is that about right?
Yes, I had the triplets in February, and then I was putting together my tenure case materials that summer. The timing actually worked out great because in terms of like papers coming out and things, those were all papers that I had worked on before they were born. There's really a lag between when you have your kids and when you have the publication gaps. By going up for tenure right around the same time that they were born, I hadn't yet been affected by that publication gap.
If the timing had been different, what's your take on how your university would have handled that kind of a situation?
You have the option to get a one-year extension on the tenure clock.
Per child or just per birth event?
Per birth event. Yeah, everything is per birth event. You don't get extra time off for extra babies.
There's no multiplier. That seems unfair.
Well, I ended up with plenty of time off. You get two quarters off from teaching plus the summer. So I was very happy with the sort of leave policy that I got here.
And now post-tenure, post-triplets, I guess they must be 4 years old. Do you find that having that level of family commitment has fundamentally affected your ability to do the job that you want to do it? Or I can also imagine that it'd be a situation where you're just much more focused when you are at work and you might even end up accomplishing more than you did before having the children.
Well, I definitely do have to be focused when I'm at work because it's the only time I have to get anything done. But, you know, my level of productivity is not as high as if I didn't have kids, but that's life, you know?
Yeah.
That's the balance I want. I wouldn't have wanted a life where it was all career and no family. So I'm happy with my balance.
And when you talk with your colleagues that are your age, what's the feeling that you get for the way that American academia is now approaching those kinds of choices that people are trying to make?
I can't really speak for what other people might be thinking. Sort of my opinion about it is that the extra 1 year extension is sort of a double-edged sword because, as I said, if the timing had been different and I had had them earlier before I was going up for tenure, I would have had a 1 year extension, but I wouldn't have gotten anything done. And
it wouldn't have really helped. You would have been in the same situation.
Yeah. So I think really when cases are going up and being considered, that you need to change the denominator of papers over how many years rather than having an extension, right? You say, well, what was her productivity over this time period? And say, but really we should subtract. It wasn't really, if it had been 6 years, it wasn't really 6 years, it was 5 years. I think that would be sort of a more realistic way of dealing with it.
Do you see that actually happening, or is this just sort of a discussion that's taking place?
Having been on search committees and you're evaluating people's productivity, and I look at the female applicants and I wonder, you know, I don't have that information of, did they have kids and did that affect their productivity? And I kind of wish I had that information so that I could make the adjustment to the denominator. But
that's the kind of information that people are, I don't know if they're legally not allowed to consider in applications or not, but you're right. It would be useful to have that.
Right.
And I've seen some Europeans, I think in particular Germans, who will have on their website and on their professional material, like their CV, they will say how many kids they have. And I don't know if that's by design or just by cultural preference.
I would sort of encourage people who are applying for jobs that if you had to take time off for whatever personal reason, you could put a note on your CV that, you know, I've worked this many years and I've had this much time off. So really this productivity is occurred over this amount of time.
Right.
I don't know how other people might use that information, but to me, I would use that information to try to evaluate people fairly.
When I was going through the tenure process, of course, you're asking your promotion and tenure committee, you're asking your dean, what does it take to get tenure? And there would be lots of hemming and hawing, people saying, well, you know, there's many ways to be a successful academic and many ways to get tenure. But we've never seen somebody who publishes 3 papers a year and gets $100,000 in grant money get denied tenure. When you were going through the process at UC Santa Barbara, did you have any kind of similar guidance, or was it just unclear to you what the threshold was going to be?
I didn't receive a specific threshold. I actually, because of the level that I started at, went up for tenure after 4 years instead of the normal 6. You know, I had the options of delaying if I wanted to. And so I asked my colleagues, do you think I'm in good shape for this or not? And they said, oh, you're in good shape. And also, if it hadn't worked out, I could just have gone up again in 2 years. For me, I wasn't stressing about it because I was getting that feedback and I had the sort of backup plan and there was so much else going on in my life right then that
yeah,
going up for tenure really wasn't like high on my list of what I was worrying about.
During that pre-tenure run-up in 2010, you had a paper that's using the Delta C13 for trying to reconstruct atmospheric CO2. And from what I can tell looking at your papers, that's the only paper that you published on CO2 reconstructions. And it just reminds me of the fact that people are always sort of dipping their toes into different pools scientifically, and some of them seem really inviting and a great place to dive in on the long term. And some of them seem like, I'm not sure I want to go in that direction. Can you comment on that paper in particular, the CO2 reconstruction, why you were interested and why it didn't end up, at least from what I can tell, being a major long-term theme for your research?
I am interested in, of course, how can you be how can you study climate and not be interested in CO2, right?
Yes.
So mainly I'm interested in how ocean circulation is affecting climate. And one of the main ways that it affects climate is through changes in carbon storage. And so that paper was really motivated by the fact that I was looking at ocean records of not just oxygen isotopes, but also carbon isotopes to try to understand circulation changes and trying to find out what information is embedded in those signals, trying to look at what's the link between ocean circulation and CO2 changes. So it's not so much that I wasn't really motivated from the direction of, oh, I want to find a good way to estimate CO2. It was, I want to find out what information is in the ocean and what the relationship is between things in the ocean and atmospheric CO2. I consider that I am still interested in that, and I'm just sort of exploring it in different directions as well. I do have a lot of papers about C13 gradients.
Yes.
And so that was a paper about C13 gradients and relating them to atmospheric CO2. And so I don't really consider it an anomaly compared to the other things that I'm doing.
Can you explain a little bit about what you learn from the delta C13 gradients?
Unfortunate notation, but delta C13 is the ratio of carbon 13 to carbon 12 in the delta notation, where you're looking at the ratio relative to a standard. So then when you add an extra delta in front of it, it means you're looking at the difference between two delta C13 records from different locations. Mm-hmm. That's telling you about changes in carbon storage in the ocean.
So this might be looking from the South Pacific to the North Pacific, or from the Atlantic to the Pacific, or are you looking at smaller gradients typically?
Well, so in that, the paper on CO2 was looking at the gradient between the deep ocean and the sort of more intermediate depth ocean. And that's important for CO2 because the intermediate depth ocean is in pretty good communication with the atmosphere, whereas in the deep ocean, you can really sequester the CO2 away from the atmosphere for a long time. So that's a way of looking at how much carbon have you stored away in the deep ocean out of communication with the atmosphere.
So the deep ocean carbon is going to reenter the system through the long-term sort of volcanic cycles. Is that right? Or I guess there's still upwelling of that, and when you have Ekman pumping on coastal areas through those processes.
Well, so you have the thermohaline circulation for the deep ocean, which operates on timescales of thousands of years. But if you change sort of the way you increase the carbon storage of the deep ocean is when you slow down the rate at which that deep water is circulated back up to the atmosphere. So the slower you circulate it, the more out of equilibrium it can be with the atmosphere.
I think it was around the same time as your LOR4 paper. Jerry McManus had a paper in Nature looking at protactinium thorium evidence of shutdown of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. And since then, there's been quite a bit of debate about to what degree the AMOC actually did shut down or could shut down during things like Heinrich events. And now you have people looking at both protactinium thorium, but also neodymium as tracers. When you look at those kinds of proxies, and then you're working with your own evidence from C13 and oxygen 18, what's your current thinking about the degree to which major climate shifts like Dansgaard-Escher events or Heinrich events have the potential to almost or fully shut down the AMOC?
I think shutdown is kind of a loaded word, right?
Yeah.
I think what you get really is much shallower circulation, perhaps further south. It's not like the water ever is like completely stagnant. But I do think that the circulation strength does get very, very weak, like during Heinrich events. I had a paper in GRL with a grad student, Joe Stern, where we were looking at C14 reservoir ages of the North Atlantic. Based on that, we said, yeah, it looks like there was a very strong reduction in circulation strength during Heinrich Event 1 of the last glacial termination. I think that there are large changes, but maybe just the word shutdown is a little kind of extreme.
When you think about the kind of inferences you've drawn from that paper and that other people have drawn from the other records, and then you think about the ongoing debate about the modern AMOC and its potential for shut down. Do you think that the individual reductions, let's call it, or reorganizations of the AMOC are so individualistic that it's difficult to draw a conclusion about what might happen in the future with increased melting from Greenland from events like H1? Or do you think that we're gaining enough physical understanding of the system to have an increase in confidence going forward about what is likely to happen with the modern AMOC?
So obviously an event like Heinrich Event 1, you can't say it's the same as what would happen in the future. So the background climate state was totally different. But I think the utility comes from being able to test the models of circulation strength. It's kind of what drove me into studying paleoclimate data. And when I start, even though I started out in modeling, is that the modeling was not able to capture the fine scale detail that you need in order to actually simulate overturning in a realistic way. It's just notoriously difficult to try to get the overturning circulation changes right in the past. Still, model runs for the glacial maximum. Some have more overturning and some have less overturning. And it's just a really hard problem to try to simulate deep water formation that happens very sporadically and on small spatial scales within a GCM.
If you hit any GCM hard enough with a hosing experiment, if you give it a spare drip for enough time, all the models will quote unquote shut down. But what you're saying is that trying to get the real nuances that we have from the observational data into the models and getting the models to reproduce those is actually far more difficult.
Right. Yeah. Is that you want a realistic result with a realistic amount of forcing. I hope that the work that I'm doing with data compilations will really contribute to the effort of improving model simulations of overturning circulation. One thing that I'm involved with right now is a PAGES working group called OC3, Ocean Circulation and Carbon Cycling, where we're working to compile carbon isotope data from all the ocean sediment cores that have been collected and where it's been measured, and try to get them all into a single database so that we have as much data as possible for comparison with GCM simulations.
I heard a talk by Olivier Marchal at this point, maybe 8 years ago. And at the time, he had explored the possibility of taking the Delta C13 records globally and using them in a data simulation context. And he said basically that it was not possible because you just didn't have anywhere near the data density that you would need to constrain the models in an assimilation approach. Is that an area of interest for the community, or is that not viewed as being a viable possibility?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're working on it. So I think for the glacial maximum, we have somewhere between 400 or 500 C13 records. That sounds like a big number to me, but then when you actually spread it over the entire volume of the ocean,
it's nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. So another thing that I'm working on is 3D visualization of oceanographic data. So we're working on how do you interpolate between those 400 or 500 points to fill in the giant empty areas in the Pacific. And so you have to work with computer scientists to work on those algorithms to try to fill in those empty spaces and figure out what like the boundary between North Atlantic deep water and Antarctic bottom water would be.
Is it some kind of horrible Frankenstein monster of 3D kriging, or is it some kind of totally different approach?
I've been working with some people at UC Davis and also with Jake Gebbie at Woods Hole. Mm-hmm. And so we've actually had several different people working on different techniques for doing it, trying to do it in some computationally reasonable way. Are there interpolations that aren't too computationally expensive and build in some information about sort of the stratified nature of the ocean? So we've actually come up with a few different techniques, and we're at the stage now where we want to compare the techniques and mm-hmm. do all the different techniques give you similar answers? Does one technique work better than another? So that's sort of the approach we've taken, is to try a few different techniques and then come back together and compare them and see where we've ended up.
Hopefully it won't be as uncertain as the benthic reconstructions of sea level at the MIS-11. Beyond the 3D reconstructions of ocean circulation, what are you going to be working on, do you think, for the next few years? What's looking exciting to you?
These carbon isotope compilations, that'll be something that will go on for the next few years. And another thing that I'm really working on, that sort of I've been working on throughout, is the age models for things. So I think that'll continue to be a theme, you know, sort of throughout my career, and working on improving uncertainty estimates for age models. Looking now at the time period where we can compare oxygen isotope alignments with radiocarbon alignments, I mean, one issue that's sort of come up is like the Skinner and Shackleton paper, I think was 2005, where they saw a 4,000-year age difference between the Atlantic and the Pacific in the timing of oxygen isotope change over the glacial termination. Of course, if I'm working on wiggle matching oxygen isotopes, then that's a concern, right? If there's 4,000 years difference in the timing of oxygen 18 change. So that's another thing that I'm working on right now, is to get a better handle on what are those differences in timing between oxygen 18 and in different parts of the ocean, and sort of what's the best way to proceed forward with oxygen 18 age models, because that's what you have when you go further back in time. And even for a lot of cores for the deglaciation, 2/3 of them don't have radiocarbon data, a lot of the historical ones. The radiocarbon data from some locations are susceptible to reservoir age changes. And so if you don't know what those reservoir age changes are, you still need some other approach to get at age models.
Lorraine Lazicki is trying to make some fundamental progress on one of the biggest issues in paleoclimate, which is the age models, and looking at 3D ocean circulation going forward. Lorraine, thanks so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome.
That was my interview with Lorraine Lazicki from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Hope you enjoyed that. And as always, you know, the opinions here are mine and those of my guests, not any kind of official position of Nature or our publisher. If you like the podcast and want others to find it, I encourage you to leave a review on iTunes. It helps with searchability quite a bit. The show notes are available at forecastpod.org, and you can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. And the show is also available on Stitcher. Feedback and critiques are always welcome, as well as suggestions for future guests. Thanks a lot.